Honourable Dr. Andrew Lee, MP, Professor Christopher Findlay, Executive Dean, Faculty of the Professions, distinguished ladies and gentlemen. I'm Associate Professor Mandar Oak. I'm the head of the School of Economics here at the University. On behalf of my colleagues in the school, I welcome you to this evening's function, which is the launch of our exciting new program, Bachelor of Economics Advanced. Before we begin this evening's proceedings, I wish to acknowledge that we gather here on the ancestral lands of the Kaurna people, original custodians of the Adelaide Plains and the land on which the University of Adelaide's campuses of Wait, Theberton, Roseworthy, as well as North Terrace are built. The order of proceedings for this evening is as follows. First, we'll hear a lecture by Dr. Andrew Lee, titled Equal to the Core. This lecture will be then followed by a Q&A for about 15 minutes, after which my colleague, Associate Professor Ralph Baer, will launch the BEC Advanced program to the audience. And we'll conclude by having refreshments which are provided for us outside in the lobby. And the refreshments are non-alcoholic because we have students here. So let me introduce our special guest and speaker for the day, Honorable Dr. Andrew Lee, MP. Dr. Lee is the Shadow Assistant Treasurer and a federal member for the seat of Fraser. Before entering politics in 2010, he was a professor in the Research School of Economics at the Australian National University. His research spans various fields such as labor economics, public finance, and political economy. He has published over 50 journal articles in these disciplines, as well as in the fields of public policy and law. And his research findings have been discussed in the Australian Financial Review, The Economist, The New York Times, Sydney Morning Herald, Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, and Washington Post. Dr. Lee holds a Bachelor of Arts Honours and an LLB Honours from the University of Sydney, and an MPA and a PhD from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He has also previously worked as a lawyer for Minter Ellison Sydney and Clifford Chance London, and as an associate to Justice Michael Kirby for the High Court of Australia. In 2011, Dr. Lee was awarded the Economic Society of Australia's Young Economist Award. This award, presented once every 2 years, was given to honor the Australian economist under the age of 40, who is deemed to have made a significant contribution to economic thought and knowledge. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Andrew Lee.
Well, thank you very much, Vanda, for that very generous introduction. Can I acknowledge many friends and colleagues here? My parliamentary colleague, Anne McEwen, thank you very much for being here tonight, Anne. Many academic colleagues and particularly many students who have joined us today. Like Vanda, can I also acknowledge we're meeting on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people and pay my respects, their elders past and present. I couldn't be more delighted to be with you this evening on this terrific occasion, the launch of the University's Bachelor of Economics Advanced degree. I know your degree will be one of only two available in Australia, and as the other one will be available in Melbourne, I'm serenely confident yours will be better. When I was Parliamentary Secretary to Prime Minister Julia Gillard, I'm sure she once told me that she was glad to have had the dual benefit of a Melbourne degree, an Adelaide education. Or maybe I made that up. But never mind, I read from the publicity that your degree will be both a pathway to honours and a springboard into leadership. And I suppose as long as there's a ladder of opportunity at the end of the pathway providing access up to the springboard, it'll all work out just fine. Your aspiration is admirable, and I congratulate you for it. The degree will offer seriously high-achieving entrance to the university, a seriously challenging point of entry into our discipline and into our profession. It will offer students the opportunity for achievement and the preparation for leadership, and lead them into careers in research, industry, advice, and decision. Surely, we've never needed that more. I was invited here and have been introduced to you as an economist committed to public service, which is flattering but slightly coy. It's a bit like describing Mike Rann as a journalist committed to diplomacy. Of course, here on a great campus and at a significant academic occasion for our discipline, I understand that my achievements as Shadow Assistant Treasurer are less striking and memorable to this audience than past status as Professor of Economics at ANU. Fair enough. Not even I consider my second reading speech on Taxation Laws Amendment Bill No. 4 to be groundbreaking. But I am a politician, and what's more, a Labor politician. So I hope you'll understand that in speaking tonight about egalitarianism and inequality in Australia, I can't help but touch on the relation between politics and economics. I promise not to spend our time together speaking exclusively as Andrew Lee MP, but to pretend to speak exclusively as Professor Lee wouldn't be entirely honest either. I believe an advanced degree of the kind we celebrate tonight, with a cohort of students of the kind you hope for, and with your stated ambitions of service to the nation and leadership in the world, will not long remain simply a project for the Academy. A course like this one will raise our young people in the heartland of our discipline, but it'll do more. It'll put them on a train for the border. Across that border, there's another country into which we'll send our young economists into. And whether we call it leadership or public service or even politics, what lies over that border matters to the preparation you make here. So I've come back to tell you a bit about what the borderlands are like. And I want to be a little specific in the way I talk about that. I want to talk to you about a particular borderland between economics and politics, one that may be the biggest political and economic question of these years: equality. Last year I published Battlers and Billionaires, which tells the story of inequality in Australia, and much of what follows is drawn from there. To briefly telegraph the points I want to make tonight, despite a generation of rising inequality, there's good evidence that the Australian egalitarian ethos remains strong. There's an important role for economists to play in measuring that and advising decision makers. And the experience of the Rudd and Gillard government is that politics can make a difference. Importantly, the debate about how equal Australia is and should be is far from settled. And there are fresh areas of egalitarian endeavour ahead of us, including within the Australian Federation. Having laid out tonight's path, let us start down it from somewhere familiar. Let's start in our discipline, with the economic history, and with the facts. By today's standard, the pre-settlement Indigenous Australian and British colonial societies were incredibly equal, at least in resource terms. The reason for this was simple. Both communities lived so close to starvation that sharing resources equitably was the only way to keep people alive. One study of the Eastern Gurindji people of the Gulf of Carpentaria estimated that getting 2,000 calories a day, which is a bare minimum necessary to survive, required everyone except the youngest, oldest and sickest to forage for 9 hours a day in the wet season and 5.5 hours a day in the dry. Similarly, while the power imbalance between guards and convicts might have been colossal in early white Australia, the gap in material conditions between those two groups was far more modest. As Robert Hughes puts it in his landmark history, The Fatal Shore, hunger was the hateful equaliser between the jailer and the jailed. One study demonstrated this by analysing public records from Sydney from 1788 to 1790, which show the salary of every soldier and civilian, as well as every person's food rations and clothing allowances. By putting a price on the rations, they estimated that inequality among the British settlers was not only lower than has been observed at any other point in Australian history, but also lower than inequality in Britain, the Netherlands, and the United States at that time. From the start of white society in Australia, economic inequality lived alongside an egalitarianism of manners. Somewhat inevitably, the relatively equal distribution of resources shaped the way in which people in early Australian society related to one another as well. Back in the old country, a wealthy lord was immediately distinguishable from a rural peasant by the cut of their clothing, the diversity of their diet, and their refined manners and accent. But in the harsh environment of early colonial Australia, such markers of distinction were either inappropriate or unavailable. Colonial Australians came to treat one another as equals, because in practical terms they basically were. And we should never forget that this equality did not extend to their dealings with Indigenous Australians. What's striking about this egalitarian ethos is that it persisted through the 1800s, even as economic inequality grew. By the mid-1800s, 1 in 25 Australians worked as servants, a larger share of the workforce than today work as school teachers. If we were to take a time machine back to 19th century Australia, the extremes of wealth would remind us more of Dickens' London than the Australia we know today. Yet even as wealth and income gaps widened, visitors to colonial Australia often remarked upon the unique ethos of a nation where Jack was as good and arguably better than his master. In the 1850s, a gold digger wrote back home that rank and title have no charms in the Antipodes. In the 1880s, an essayist summed it up by saying, "In England, the average man feels he is an inferior. In America, that he is a superior. In Australia, he feels he is an equal." That is indeed delightful. Mark Twain saw it. Anthony Trollope saw it. D.H. Lawrence saw it. Wasn't a dream, and we didn't make it up. That delightfully egalitarian spirit continued to occupy an important place in Australia's national psyche throughout much of the 20th century. Economic inequality peaked around the 1920s and fell strongly in the post-war decades. It was partly due to expanding educational opportunities. My paternal grandfather, Keith Lee, couldn't have paid the fees for the University of Melbourne on his modest clergyman's wage. But for thousands of men like Keith, the post-World War II era brought new opportunities. By the 1960s, Craig McGregor noted that the wealthy in Australia feel under some pressure to be accepted by ordinary working Australians, rather than the other way around. He also cited a survey at the time which found that 54% of Australians described themselves as middle class, a considerably higher share than the 42% in the United States or the 35% of Britons who described themselves as middle class. In the same decade, Donald Horne noted, "There are no possibilities in Australia of determining social status by simple inspection." Horne wrote, "You can't place a man on the social scale by listening to his accent or what he talks about. or by looking at his clothes or observing his manners. So despite the fact that economic inequality rose through the 19th and early 20th centuries, Australians still acted like equals. That spirit was especially strong from the 1940s to the 1970s as economic inequality fell. There's good evidence that this spirit of egalitarianism persists today. Indeed, it seems to me that Australians want to become more equal. One way of measuring this is to show people different possible pictures of the income distribution and have them pick the one they prefer. In those exercises, only 19% of respondents opt for a pyramid-shaped income distribution, the few people at the top and everyone else below. Most people believe that a pyramid shape accurately describes Australian society, though few realise just how pointy the top has begun. Even so, few regard such a distribution as ideal. Indeed, the share of people who want to live in a pyramid-type society is lower now than it was in the late 1980s. Other surveys have asked people whether they agree or disagree that differences in income are too large. In 2009, 3/4 agreed, up from 2/3 in the early 1990s. Now suppose you had an equal chance of being born into any one of the 5 wealth quintiles in Australia. Would you prefer to be born into a society like the bottom one, where the rich had 60 times as much wealth as the poor? Or would you prefer a society like the top one, which is a little more egalitarian? Or indeed, would you prefer a society where the rich had only about 1.5 times as much wealth as the poorest fifth? When surveyed about the ideal distribution, the majority of Australian respondents want our nation to be more egalitarian. They prefer the top distribution to the bottom distribution. And indeed, even the most affluent respondents prefer a much more egalitarian distribution than either of the two that I've shown you. The most affluent Australians want a distribution where the richest fifth have only about 1.5 times as much wealth as the poorest fifth. So Australians don't believe equality is unrealistic or bad for the economy, and we do support egalitarian policies. But while we may express a clear preference for equality, I think we all sense that the world around us isn't arranged that way. In writing Battlers and Billionaires, I set out to test my uneasy suspicion that Australia has actually become a more unequal place in recent decades. Unfortunately, I was right. The data clearly show that Australia enjoyed a golden age of equality from about 1940 to the 1970s, followed by a rapidly growing gap between rich and poor over the past generation. To see this, let's look at a group that's got plenty of attention lately, the top 1% club. In case you're wondering whether this particular club will have you as a member, joining the top 1% today takes an individual pre-tax income of over $200,000. From the 1910s to the mid-1950s, the income share of the top 1%, which is the top line in this chart, fell from 12% to 8%. By 1980, it was down to 5%. It had more than halved. In 7 decades, the income share taken home by the top 1/100th of Australians was less than half of what it had been. During the Menzies era, real wage growth was 4% a year, 5 times faster than it had been from 1901 to 1940. For ordinary workers, the late 1950s and early 1960s, saw paid annual holidays increase from 1 week to 3 weeks a year. By the 1960s, most Australian homes had a vacuum cleaner, a washing machine, a radio and a television. There was a fridge in 97% of Australian homes in the 1960s, an appliance that a majority of homes in Britain, Germany and Italy didn't yet possess. Now, granted, we also had something the Poms didn't have, which was summer. But Australian incomes in the post-war era rose faster at the bottom than at the top. In one study, I looked at the distribution of incomes across Australian males. In an era in which men were the main breadwinners, their income said a lot about how money was distributed across families. From the early 1940s to the late 1970s, I found a significant drop in male inequality. To put the size of that equalisation in perspective, the improvement in equality over those three decades was as big a shift as you would need to bridge the modern day difference in equality between Australia and the much more equal countries of Scandinavia. Importantly, falling inequality among men was also accompanied by a steady narrowing of the gender pay gap, with the equal pay cases of 1969 and 1972 being key milestones. By the beginning of the 1980s, Australia had become a remarkably equal place, as egalitarian as at any other point since the 1700s. And then inequality began to rise. Over the past 30 years, the top 1% have almost doubled their share of household income. Cumulatively, the increase in the top 1% share from 1980 to 2009 represents a $403 billion shift from the bottom 99% to the top 1%. Let's keep on this previous chart while I talk about that. And because top incomes are rising, the figure continues to increase. In just 1 year, 2009, the rise in top incomes since 1980 represented an additional $33 billion more income for the top 1%. Put that another way, if the economy had stayed the same size, but top income shares went back to their 1980 levels, the annual incomes of the bottom 99% would rise by $33 billion, or around $4,000 for every Australian household in the bottom 99%. Now, to this point, I've mostly viewed the evidence for inequality through the lens of income, and there's plenty of it. You can also see that difference, though, if you look at earnings. It's the chart of earnings inequality adjusted for inflation over the last 35 years. And here you can see wage growth for the top 10% running three times faster than wage growth for the bottom 10%. But if you want to see some seriously large gaps, look not at what people take home each year, but at the total value of everything they earn, their wealth. In general, the poor spend everything they earn, and sometimes borrow more besides, while the rich save significant amounts. Working with Argentinian economist Pamela Katic, I pulled together data from three sources, wealth surveys, inheritance tax records, and rich lists, to build a picture of long-run wealth inequality. We see a similar pattern to that for top income shares, but with even more dramatic trends. From 1915 to 1953, the wealth share of the top 1% fell from about a third to about a seventh. By 1978, it had fallen still further, down to about 7%. But by 2010, it had ticked up again significantly, with the top 1% of Australians now owning 11% of all wealth. Now, even for a theatre full of wonks, all those numbers can be a bit hard to keep in your head at the same time. So, one way of thinking about wealth inequality is to imagine a ladder in which each rung represents $1 million of wealth. Now imagine the Australian population spread out along the ladder, with their distance from the ground reflecting their household wealth. On that ladder, most of us are just a few centimetres off the ground. Half of all households, about 5 million of them, are closer to the ground than they are to the first rung. The typical Australian household has a wealth of about $500,000. So there they are, halfway to the first rung. A household in the top 10% is about 1.5 rungs up. This ladder we're sitting here in the lecture theatre, it would be about knee height. Top 10% household would be about knee height. About 10 million families are below that point, and only about 1 million above. 5 rungs up, what would be about neck level in a regular ladder, you can find the households in the top 1%. At her current wealth, you'll be asking, where is Gina Rinehart? Still looking, still moving. And now, Gina Rinehart is 6 kilometres off the ground. On the ladder analogy, people like Gina are so far up, they look down on the Mile High Club. Another way to measure inequality is to look at the share of people living on less than half the median income. In Anti-Poverty Week, this is a measure which has attracted a lot of public commentary. And the measure known as relative poverty has increased in each of the 1980s, the 1990s and the 2000s. Just as the top is accelerating away from the middle, so too is the middle falling down, gotten away from the bottom. If you think of inequality as being like a horse race, yes, everyone is moving in the same direction. But the front runners are accelerating away from the pack, while the laggards are falling further behind. So whichever way you cut it, it's clear from the data that Australia has become a more unequal place over the past generation. I believe this is important. I believe it matters, and here's why. In a recent speech to the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, I argued that Australia needs to promote and maintain a unified national identity based on shared values. We need this national identity to help us sustain social cohesion as our communities inevitably become more ethnically, culturally and religiously diverse through globalisation and transnational migration. This evening I want to say to you that egalitarianism should be one of those core values. In fact, I'll go further. Egalitarianism is perhaps the value that has the best potential to unite Australians now and in the changing years ahead. We have been and can be still egalitarian to the core. I'm convinced that our egalitarian spirit helped make Australia a stable, cohesive and prosperous nation over the past 2 centuries. I'm convinced we have this ethos still strongly present in our society, even as inequality has risen starkly and significantly over the past generation. I believe egalitarianism is a value that runs deep in the Australian popular psyche, with undeniable origins in a history and culture, an undeniable continued appeal in our society. But I worry that unless Australian leaders consciously refocus on equality as our shared goal and egalitarianism as our common value, we'll lead our people into a more unequal and divided future. To be blunt, a more egalitarian, more unequal Australian is a less egalitarian one. And this is simply not a value we can afford to let fade away. We're now not just talking economics anymore. We start talking about values, about the kind of Australia we want to be. We've entered those borderlands. Then we're in the realm of politics and government. Because it is often government that chooses a path and guides our collective steps along it. When government doesn't choose, others choose for us. Governments of different political persuasions make very different choices. These can have far-reaching consequences for equality in Australia. Consider Australia's political history. World War II marked an important shift in the social compact, partly because so many citizens had vivid memories of living through World War I. In 1939, unlike in 1914, there was a widespread recognition of the collective sacrifice that war entailed, and a strong belief that that sacrifice had to be fairly shared across the community. Prime Minister John Curtin told Parliament in 1942, "There will have to be a fairer distribution of wealth." Various measures were put in place to achieve this. Prices and rents were controlled, and so workers didn't see their costs escalating while their wages were frozen. Income taxes were federalised, and the tax base expanded, so the average worker paid tax for the first time. Tax rates were increased for the more affluent as well, with the top marginal tax rate reaching 93% in the latter years of the war. The effect of all those changes was to reduce the after-tax incomes of the rich and boost the buying power of the poor. Post-war Australia also held on to a social safety net that included age pensions, introduced in 1909-1910, child endowment, 1941, widow's pension, 1942, funeral benefits, 1943, and unemployment benefits, 1945. Yet in 1950, we still spent less per person on those programs than the United Kingdom, the United States, or New Zealand. And a key reason for this was the decision to means test the age pension. Other countries provided benefits that were equal across the board, or maybe even linked to earnings, which made them more generous to those at the top. An idea whose time has apparently returned in some circles. Those countries' welfare states acted like piggy banks, helping people smooth income across their lives. But from an early stage, the Australian welfare state specifically redistributed income from the rich to the poor, like the age pension, the invalid and widow's pension were similarly means tested. And that focus on the neediest was a key feature of Australian welfare. It's one reason our system is fairer and more sustainable. And it's an important distinction between our system and those of many countries overseas. In all the debates over our fiscal future, including those arising from the fact that people are living longer, this shouldn't be forgotten. The Rudd government's decision in 2009 to boost the single age pension by over $1,600 a year reduced the share of people living in poverty by one-fifth. For those of you who work on poverty, you'll know that such an increase is unprecedented. A single government decision that took one in five people out of poverty. When the global financial crisis hit, that government delivered household stimulus through means-tested social payments that were progressive and temporary, not tax cuts, which would have been regressive and permanent. The Gillard government's National School Improvement Plan was also aimed at distributing resources more fairly to improve outcomes for those in disadvantaged areas, ensuring postcodes didn't define the destiny of Australian schoolchildren. The Gillard government means tested family payments like Family Tax Benefit Part B and other benefits like the private health insurance rebate. And because of choices like these, the Rudd and Gillard governments can be proud that inequality did not significantly increase during the period 2007 to 2013. Now, as I've shown you on a previous slide, Tony Atkinson and I have been annually producing estimates of inequality measured by the income share of the top 1%. This year we handed the conch over to Roger Wilkins, Richard Birkhauser and Marcus Hahn. And their results, reported in the media in July, showed the top income inequality hadn't grown in the period since about 2007. It was sort of amusing to me to see how these results were reported in the press. Last year, one serious paper reported on page one, "Inequality rises under class warrior Swan's watch." But it couldn't present a skerrick of evidence to actually back up the claim. And then this year, another serious paper reported that the flatlining of inequality since 2007 proved that Labor figures like Mr. Swan and myself were wrong to make inequality a political issue. Some of our critics are pretending that Labor exacerbated inequality. Others contend that the failure of inequality to grow under Labor means inequality doesn't matter. We can't win. The fact is, the global financial crisis did play a part in stemming the growth in inequality. But that's not the whole of the story. Governments can make a difference, as the Rudd and Gillard governments did, by holding back the tide of systemic financial collapse. Governments can also make a difference in quite a different way, as the Abbott coalition government seems set to do. The incoming coalition government's first budget contained many policies that, if they're enacted, will make Australia a more unequal country. In some respects, that's actually the stated goal. They express it in guarded terms, like incentive and entitlement. But the goal is evident, nonetheless. For example, the proposed changes to the Newstart allowance would see unemployed young Australians left without income for up to 6 months, forcing many to rely on family or charity to meet their daily needs. Plans to apply a government bond rate of interest to student loans could likewise place tertiary study out of the reach of children from poor families. The proposal to index pensions to prices rather than wages is profound. It means that pensioners will no longer share in any of the increase in general living standards across the community. At the same time as introducing these measures which hurt people lower in the income distribution, the government's pursued policies which help those at the higher end. It's repealed the mining tax, which will benefit some of the richest people on the planet, indeed, some of the richest humans who've ever lived. The government's maintained extremely generous tax concessions for people with more than $2 million in superannuation. These retirees receive more government assistance than someone on the full pension. Indeed, someone with $20 million in superannuation is receiving nearly $500,000 every year of government assistance. And at the same time, the government is proposing to cut the low-income super contribution scheme, which helps those on limited incomes save for their retirement. So while the government plans lower taxes for people earning over $1 million or with more than $2 million in their super accounts, it planned higher superannuation taxes for people earning less than $37,000 a year. Luckily, my party and our crossbench colleagues in the Senate were able to defeat that particular plan, as we intend to do with the New Start, the pension and the higher ed changes. And we'll oppose those changes because they'll make society less equal. And in that respect, it's clear from measured public opinion that Labor's far from alone. Indeed, if the first Conservative federal budget since 2007 has been bad for equality might have actually been good for egalitarianism. For the first time in a long while, questions of fairness and equity have been occupying front pages and front bar debate across Australia. Certainly no one can have missed the noisy and passionate public discussion about whether the budget was fair. But there's another argument about equality coming, and for the moment it's approaching with greater stealth. I'm thinking of the Federation, a literal constitution of our commonwealth. A few months ago, the Prime Minister launched a review on reform of the Federation. It's the opening salvo in a debate about how our 100-year-old system of government should be renewed for the future. Now, it's clear from the terms of reference provided that the government has more in mind than a bit of spring cleaning. Major renovations are on the cards. The Coalition has flagged a smaller role for the Commonwealth Government, reducing or eliminating overlapping areas of service and funding delivery, providing more autonomy and equity for state governments. It's hard to disagree with any of these things as principles, but if we care about equality, we must keep a watchful eye on what they end up meaning in practice. Federalism is a fundamentally egalitarian institution because it supports states in times when they're doing it tough. As industries rise and fall, different states will do better at some times and worse at other times. This is an inevitable fact of economic growth, but it does mean that, left alone, economic change would batter individual states hard. Federalism means we share some of the upside and help states during the downside. And you've only got to look back over history to recognise how hard it is to predict the snakes and ladders of economic fortune. Challenges facing a great state like the one we find ourselves in tonight are caused by the decline of manufacturing and the historically high Australian dollar, among varied other causes. None of you are any less capable because you happen to be born Croatians. That understanding underpins the principle of horizontal fiscal equalisation. Just as our personal tax system enables those with the most to support those with the least, so too federalism enables states that are doing well to support those that aren't doing so well. That's egalitarianism on a national scale. That's a proud achievement of our federation. The state you live in shouldn't define your access to proper services and infrastructure any more than your postcode should decide this within individual cities. Princeton University's Paul Krugman makes this point by comparing the European Union with the United States. Both have similar populations, but the former is primarily a monetary union, while the latter is also a fiscal union. As has frequently been pointed out, Greece has lower productivity than the Eurozone average, and that's contributed to the economic slump that might last the better part of a generation. In the United States, a state like Mississippi also has lower productivity than the US national average. But fiscal transfers mean that its economic outlook today is far rosier than that of Greece. The United States, of course, is hardly the world's most egalitarian nation. But even there, its federal structure has a redistributive effect. In Australia, our federal system means that we reach back to prevent those in need from falling behind. Labor won't let this Commonwealth become a place of hoarded wealth. I can also tell you that we won't support scaling back the Commonwealth capacity's roles and responsibilities unless it's clear that states have the capacity and resources to step up to the plate. We won't let simplified government become a euphemism for service cuts and sliding standards across our health and education system. Let me say it again. Federalism is a fundamentally egalitarian way of structuring a nation. If we dismantle or drastically alter that structure, we can expect to see rising inequality between places, just as we've seen it rising between people in recent decades. Labor won't stand for that. We'll stand up to any party or government which claims a greatly diminished federation would be in the interests of our collective commonwealth. Let me finish by addressing the undergraduates here tonight. I said earlier that I'd come back to tell you what the borderlands are like, to tell you something about that other country, politics, where economics matters so much. I took that as my theme because we're launching an advanced degree in economics. We do so with the knowledge that economics matters to politics. Let me skip over that. We'll go back here. And we do so in the knowledge that economics matters to politics and society. But I want to be more specific than that. I don't only believe economics matters. I believe economists matter. You matter. Our discipline is by far the most influential social science in our society. And arguably today our profession is even more influential than the law. Although it's possible that being an ex-lawyer might have just slightly coloured my view on that question. And I want you to know that along with affording you great opportunities, it also delivers you a great responsibility. As Keynes put it, writing in a rather more male-dominated era, the master economist must possess a rare combination of gifts. He must be a mathematician, historian, statesman, philosopher, in some degree. He must understand symbols and speak in words. He must contemplate the particular in terms of the general and touch abstract and concrete in the same flight of thought. He must study the present in the light of the past for the purposes of the future. No part of man's nature or his intuitions must lie entirely outside his regard. Perhaps that passage, Sexism Omitted, could be the course description for the degree that we're launching tonight. The private rewards available in this society for people who can count have never been greater. And if you want, you can take the skills you learn here and use them to plant your own personal money tree on your back porch and tend to it for years. Yes, you can. Or if you want, you can cultivate the same tree on common ground. Only you can decide, but I want you to know that I think you will find this is the better life. Thank you, and good luck in all your endeavours.
Your book, The Billionaires and Battlers, recently, and in your conclusions you make this proposal we should have randomized control trials on economic and social policy. One, do you think that's ever going to happen? And B, even if it's going to happen, doesn't that kind of violate egalitarian spirit because you're treating two people who are essentially, hopefully, identical in most respects differently?
Great question. So I don't think there's anything inegalitarian with the medical randomized trials that go on all the time. In fact, if we had a world in which we didn't test new cures for cancer using a randomized trial, those who suffered the most would arguably be the most vulnerable in the community. If we think that's the right way of evaluating new pharmaceuticals, I'm not sure why we shouldn't use the same insights
in improving our social policies. And in fact, this isn't just abstract. In New South Wales, the Nudge Unit, borrowed from the British Behavioural Insights Unit, is already randomising its tax infringement notices. It has to send out thousands of notices every year. So why send the same notice every time? Why not tweak the notice, toss a coin, and see which one gets higher levels of repayment? And it turns out, for example, that if you want to increase repayment rates, it helps to remind people who failed to pay their taxes on time that they're in the minority in not doing that. Encourage them to be part of the social norm. In New South Wales, again, the New South Wales Drug Court was subjected to a randomised trial, providing rigorous evidence that a process which puts drug offenders through drug treatment is more effective in terms of the benefits for society than one that simply locks up drug offenders for a year in a jail and hopes that somehow they beat the habit. So yes, I think it's egalitarian to test our social programs, and I'd love to see more scientific and critical evaluation of the social programs we're rolling out.
Just to plan time, we'll be taking two questions. Sorry,
just a quick question. In relation to the surveys about equality and people's views on equality, why then isn't it easier to sell the message of equality? Is it that people are lying on those surveys and really actually they might say that they want equality or they want things to be better for others, but in fact people are inherently selfish?
Great question. Now, should I take another one or should I answer that straight away?
I'm
sure there is, as with any economic analysis, some divergence between what we call stated preference and revealed preference. But I can't help noticing that there is a trend, nonetheless, towards people preferring greater egalitarianism. And to the extent that revealed and stated preference are out of whack, they should have been out of whack in the 1980s, when a whole lot fewer people preferred egalitarian policies. So I think there is something in what we've seen changing, and I think there is an opportunity for a conversation about fairness. There's a great pride, I find, when people remember that Australia is a country which doesn't much like tipping, where we sit in the front seat of taxis, where there's no areas in the private beaches, and we don't stand up when our Prime Minister enters the room. Ours is a nation whose favourite horse race is one that literally puts lead in the saddlebags in order to make it a more interesting race. So there's a lot about the egalitarian ethos that taps into what it is to be Australians.
Actually, we can take a few more questions.
I'm not time constrained, so it's up to you.
Member from Economics has considered it's time for you.
Excellent.
So I don't understand the policy of the big miners over in WA at the moment by digging more and paying less. Wouldn't you dig less and keep the price up?
Only if you're a price maker. So there is no major commodity for which Australia sets the world price. But this is absolutely what De Beers did with diamonds. So if you have a supply monopoly, then you really want to restrict output. De Beers hoarded a whole lot of their diamond output and ensured that they just released enough in order to keep the price high. On top of that, they also ran quite clever campaigns to introduce the idea of engagement rings into cultures like the Japanese, which didn't have an engagement ring culture before De Beers came along. There's no such opportunities available to Australian miners. They're price takers on the world stage, and they're massively ramping up their output. It's extraordinary. I was in the Pilbara recently. They're now shipping out in just a month what we used to ship out in an entire year. And this is essentially a large conveyor belt operation taking huge chunks of Pilbara earth and getting them to China as efficiently as possible.
Your party, the Labor Party, has consistently been seen by the Australian public for a good 30 years as bad on economics, and the Liberal Party has always been seen as good on economics. Is there a way that the Labor Party can sell a message of reform or economic competence in the same way that the Hawke-Keating government did in the modern circumstance where there is a very different sort of perception of the way wealth and income work?
Great. So there is some stuff that's stable and some that we can move. It is an empirical regularity across all the developed countries where I've looked at surveys that parties of the left are regarded as better managers on health and education, and parties of the right are regarded as being more competent on national security and taxation. That's true whether those parties are in government or out of government, and it's true as far back as I'm able to see. Incidentally, it was also true of the Hawke and Keating governments. But it is important that we're very clear about the fact that we face constraints and trade-offs. Resources are not infinite. Milton Friedman was absolutely right when he said that to spend is to tax. And that's, I think, one reason why means testing is absolutely fundamental. Because means testing recognises that there's a deadweight cost of taxation, that when we raise taxes, that has an impact on work effort and investment volumes. And that we ought to make sure that those tax dollars that are raised are being used as efficiently as possible. And that means trying to avoid welfare churn in which values destroyed in favour of targeted social assistance. We've done that very well in Australia, and it's not just good social policy, it's good economic policy as well. It's much more efficient way of achieving things. I don't think I've got a magic bullet towards improving Labor's economic standing, but I think, you know, having gotten Australia through the biggest global downturn since the Great Depression without a recession, we ought to at least get a small tick on the economic management card.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your talk.
Thank you.
I'm an avid listener of your podcast, and you have described yourself in the past as a social liberal. Social liberal seems a strange home for you then in the Labor Party, but increasingly it would be a stranger home for you to be in the Liberal Party. So I was wondering, for those homeless small little liberals like myself, where do you see the future of small little liberal politics?
So it's up for grabs at the moment. The big story of smaller liberalism in Australia is that Deakin's Liberals are uncertain in the first decade of the Federation whether they will go with the Conservatives or with the Egalitarians. And ultimately, due to things like caucus solidarity on my side of politics, they plump in Australia to go with the Conservatives. And so the right in Australia is an amalgam of conservatism and liberalism for much of Australia's history. And that's now breaking down. The so-called Liberal Party has opposed uses of markets on carbon pricing, and I think taken a range of less liberal positions on various social issues such as same-sex marriage, where I think there is you can regard same-sex marriage as being a social liberal issue. So I think small L liberalism was married to the Conservatives from 1909 through to a decade ago, and it's now back on the altar. And I think we ought to be standing there as a possible suitor, because the marriage of egalitarianism and small L liberalism is a powerful one. And I think at that intersection lies the future for modern Labor.
I'm going to use the bad word, the P word, Piketty. And he argues for a progressive international wealth tax. I haven't seen you comment on that, and I wonder where you stand on such a, well, what might be called an extreme position?
Well, first of all, Piketty, it is to Piketty that we owe a lot of this work. So the top 1% series I showed you has its genesis in Piketty estimating that series for France, Tony Atkinson doing it for Britain, me running into Tony Atkinson while I was at Harvard, and Tony and I doing the series for Australia and New Zealand. It warms the cockles of my heart when a book by a 700-page book on inequality by an economist makes the Amazon bestseller list. But even Thomas acknowledges that that his wealth tax approach is politically impossible. I'd much rather focus on stuff that I think we get is more tractable and politically viable. The randomised policy trial issue has been mentioned before, but also investment in high-quality education. It worries me that in Australian schools we have too many instances of teachers beginning their careers teaching affluent kids and finishing their careers teaching vulnerable kids. I think that ought to concern people right across the Australian political spectrum.
One last question.
And you mentioned the Commonwealth Government's current review of federal arrangements, and in the discussions of that, one of the things that's talked about is pushing responsibility for funding school education back to the states. Now, firstly, do you think that there's a problem with the arrangement whereby the Commonwealth raises revenue, provides it to the states that then operate the schools? Is there a problem in the main with the way that that currently operates? And if there is a problem, is an alternative solution for the Commonwealth to actually take more control of the operations of schools, to take it away from the states if they're not doing it properly?
So the economics of federalism, as I see it, is the tension between wanting the unit that raises the revenue to do the spending and the efficiency gains from that, versus wanting the revenue to be raised as efficiently as possible. Going back to state-based income taxes, I think, would be a bit of a hodgepodge, and not to mention many of the even more efficient inefficient state taxes we've had in the past. So I'm not particularly troubled by the Commonwealth raising revenue and passing some of it to the states. What has concerned me is the lack of egalitarian investment in schools by state governments. And that was part of one of the big drivers for the National Plan for School Improvement, making sure that disadvantaged schools got additional resources. And you see this if you go into, you know, a low-income school that now can afford literacy and numeracy coaches, literacy and numeracy experts able to work with teachers to make sure that their teaching's up to best practice. Or assistance which allows disadvantaged kids in those schools to get a little bit more targeted one-on-one assistance. We haven't typically done that as well as we could in Australia, and so I think the Commonwealth role in improving egalitarianism is important, driven by what I think is another really important egalitarian reform, which is the spotlight of my school, making very clear how different schools are performing. And allowing resources to be directed to those most in need.
Okay. Thanks, we are running over time, but that's a testimony to your great speech. And thanks for showing us the relationship between economics and politics and its importance for our BA advanced students. So as a token of our affection and gratitude, is an alcoholic gift for you.
Thank you.
And please join me in thanking.
Thank you very much.
Now I hand it over to Ralph to launch the BA Advanced program.
I'm really in trouble now because everything I want to say has actually been said by Andrew already. All these great things. So I've written this nice speech here which I can put away. My name is Ralph Bayer. I'm the deputy head of school and I'm the coordinator of this brand new degree. And let me just say that much. I'm really not a fan of slogans. My dean knows this, sitting here. Slogans, visions, missions, all that stuff floating around in the higher education marketing are often quite vain or whatever, but with this one, I have a slogan, and Andrew had already talked about it, and the slogan is really educating leaders. But it's not empirically empty, because we have a big tradition of actually educating leaders. If you think about our graduates, so the current Secretary for Treasury is one of ours. One of the assistant governors of the Reserve Bank is one of ours. The Australian ambassador to China is one of ours. We have a vice president of Credit Suisse. We have lots of people in great positions in the private sector as well, and also in academia. So we have proven that we are actually educating these leaders. How have we been doing this? We've been doing this through our honors degree, our fourth year honors. And what are we doing there? We have a small group of people, the best students in our undergraduate degrees, get the opportunity of one more year, really, really small group together, pretty close to our best researchers and so on. And so we thought we build on this and bring this forward. Why are we only doing this in the fourth year? Why are we not doing this early on already? This is our new advanced degree. Basically, we provide the best students already with this experience of the research culture in our school from year one. These students starting their being advanced will have special courses in year one, two, three, which will be only for them in small groups in the cohort with multiple people from our department per course, really close research oriented. Successful graduates from the BEEC Advanced will gain automatic entry in the fourth year, honors. So it links into this honors degree that has been so successful. We've arranged for the opportunity to have majors in other areas, for example, major in social sciences fits well, and clearly, listen to Andrew, there are also the opportunities to do concurrent degrees, one, for example, together with law, which really works well. So this year, we're taking in our first small cohort of only the best students, so our entry score is 95. These students will go through the degree as a little cohort, special research-rich courses, and lots of exposure to our researchers and the visiting researchers as well. We have special events lined up, like this one, where students have special have access to people who are important in Australia, important in the world, but also who could be their future employers. While we are launching this degree today, we had a trial run, certainly. We want to make sure that things might work out nicely before you're really starting. And so last year we upgraded the best first year students to the second year of this advanced degree to see whether it works. And I've seen almost all of you guys being here. And I would say, I think it works. I think it really works. I hope you agree that the small course that you're taking right now and all the experiences like talking to a Nobel laureate, getting exposure to people in industry from the Reserve Bank and so on, what we've organized so far actually really works for you. Now, the scary part was then the first year with an entry in first year where we don't have control what the demand will be, right? So we're sweating, but we've seen that the first preferences for this degree in SATEC are, we've got about 30 of them, which will give us exactly the size of a cohort if there are about 15 to 20 that actually start that we are looking for. I was scared. So I personally am really excited about the times ahead. With this degree, I believe we can spread the enthusiasm we have for good economics to more of the smartest Australian kids. And
So with launching this degree, we reiterate as a school our commitment to world-class education and economics. So I'm really looking forward to see the cohorts go through, leave university, and then reappear in all these great leadership positions in our society, which some of the honors graduates have done before. So this is probably long enough now, so let's have some refreshments and celebrate the launch of our new Bachelor of Economics degree. Thank you.